you had to think, you know, is this my indigestion again?
Is it Jesus Christ or indigestion?
Yeah. Tablets didn't help.
I don't know what you think of when you hear Regius Professor of Divinity at the University of Oxford, but if you're anything like me, you think of stained glass, vaulted ceilings, and unlimited boredom. Breaking the mold of this stereotype is Keith Ward, who held the title from 1991, the year after I was born, to 2004, the year I began high school. Today, he will discuss with us one of Christianity's most complex doctrines, the Holy Trinity, in light of modern scientific discoveries. Welcome to Theology Live, a podcast and live event that highlights the playful dance between theology and contemporary life. I'm the Reverend Broderick Greer, curate at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live. Professor Ward, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Please tell us a little bit more about yourself and what life looks like for you right now.
Gosh, it looks, about myself. Well, I was born before the Second World War. I always lived in England. I've been to America quite a lot, but my home has been in England. I started life when I found out what philosophy was. I decided to teach it, so I did. So I became a philosopher. And I've taught philosophy in universities in Britain all my academic life. The philosophy that I was taught was very anti-religious. One of my teachers was a man called Freddie Eyre. You might not have heard of him, in which case I'm very glad. But he was known as the greatest atheist in the world at the time. He was a logical positivist. If you come across that. And a logical positivist is a person who thinks that for a word to have meaning, it must be something, must refer to something you can see or touch or feel. So the word chair, you'd say, what does it mean? And you'd hit this and say, that's what it means. And so people like Freddie Eyre said, well, the word God, just show me what it means. And of course you say, well, you know, God is not physical. Well, show me something physical. Well, what color is it? Well, it's not any color at all. Where is it? Oh, well, it's not actually anywhere. And so Freddie Eyre would say, well, so the word God has no meaning. And he would even say, I'm not even an atheist because an atheist doesn't believe in God. I'm a person who doesn't know what the word God means. So I can't not believe in it. So there you are. So he taught me philosophy anyway. The result of which was I thought his philosophy was so wrong that there must be something about God that was interesting. And that got me started on inquiring into religion. And then one way or another, I got interested in science, particularly in physics, quantum physics especially, and cosmology, the science of the early history of the universe. When quantum physics and relativity physics come together, because it talks about very, very small things, like the universe, which used to be very, very small. So, and I, luckily, teaching in Oxford and Cambridge anyway, you don't primarily live in a faculty. You don't have a subject like, you know, a faculty of medicine, you talk to medics. Faculty of physics, you talk to physicists. But if you're in Oxford College, you have dinner every night, every day, with people who are in different subjects than you. And that's one of the great things about that system, that you meet people in other subjects. So you keep asking what they do. Although with mathematicians, I would often say, what do you do? And they say, well, you don't really want to know what I do, do you? And I have to admit, I don't. So, but with physicists, I am interested because they physicists these days, and this is one of the amazing things, turn out to be very interested in God. This is hard to believe. They don't call it God, I agree. That's one preliminary thing you could get over. They would call it something like the vast intelligence which underlies the physical universe. And I say, is that God? And they say, no, that's not God. And I say, well, as far as I'm concerned, it's God. And they say, well, does he have jumble fates? And, you know, does he go around freeing the Israelites from Egypt? And no, the great intelligence behind the universe doesn't do those sorts of things, okay? So physicists tend, like Einstein is a good example. Albert Einstein did believe there is a great intelligence behind the universe. He certainly believed that. But he was a Jew, and he thought the whole Old Testament was a whole set of myths and legends, and there wasn't such a being. So you see why scientists don't, in Britain anyway, well, in the States too, actually, don't very often believe in God. Now, if you press them and you say, is the universe just a whole set of accidents? They'd say, no, not for science, really, because science has to believe everything has a cause. Things don't just happen by accident. That's not science. You couldn't do science if that was true. So there must be a reason for everything. That could be interesting. Anyway, I've gone on an awful long time about me, so I'll stop now. Well, what has that got to do with me? Oh, well, I spent the rest of my life... I spent the rest of my life talking to scientists and asking them what they think and doing especially quantum physics, which is very interesting, and relativity physics, and trying to make a connection with what I did in religion. Anyway, I found that this was near enough to God for me, so I got ordained as a priest of the Episcopal Church. So I now worship the great intelligence which underlies the universe, and if they don't call it God, that's not my fault.
You open your book, your most recent book, Christ in the Cosmos, with this admission, quote, I am writing in 21st century English, and the meanings English words have for me are very different from words in Latin or Greek from 1,500 years or more ago. That is why the words of the Athanasian Creed sometimes do not mean much to us. So any modern English speaker might use those words and mean something quite different from what the early theologians of the church had in mind. Yep. So if you could say more about the need to update our creedal vocabulary.
Okay, well, let me give you two examples of this, of words which have changed their meaning completely. In the English church, which we use, when we talk about the Book of Common Prayer, we mean something written in the 16th century, right? Now, if any of you tried reading this, you'll realize immediately that it's got words which have a different sense from anything you've ever heard before. And a good example is a prayer which prays that we may have true religion, right? It's a prayer that we might have true religion. Well, I think to most people, I'd be interested to know if it's true for you. If you talk about true religion, you're thinking about a religion which is speaking the truth. So you're really praying that everybody should be an Episcopalian. Right? So that's the true religion, right? That's what you're liable to think. But actually, in the 16th century, religion meant piety. So praying for true religion was asking the people should be truly devout. It wasn't concerned with what they believed, you know, at all, but just they should be really devout about belief. So if they were atheists, they had to be really devout atheists, okay? I don't know what that is, but anyway, it could be. And that's an example of the word religion has changed its meaning. So the other example I'd give is the Trinity itself. You probably know, I'm certain you know, the Trinity is defined as three persons in one substance. Well, I think in modern American and in modern English, that would mean three people sitting in a bowl of treacle. Right? Three persons in one substance. Well, that's not what the Trinity is, strangely enough. And so if you say, why did they say persons, and why did they say substance? In fact, the people who translated that old creed into the American liturgy realized that substance wasn't a word that people used anymore, except in chemistry, and so they changed it to being. So you get in the creed that you say in church, the Nicene Creed, you get Christ is one in being with the Father, but it's got a big B, so you think there's something funny about that. And indeed there is, because it means substance. So the word substance has been changed into the word being. But actually the word being is equally incomprehensible, because what's being one in being? I mean, am I one in being with the universe? Well, I hope so. But, you know, is the universe one in being with me? Probably not. So you've got a problem about this. So you've got to say, what did the word person originally mean? So it was, of course, written in Greek, this creed, originally, and the word was prosopon. Okay. And you might say, well, I don't know what that means. Now, one of the first people to use this was St. Augustine, way back. And he said, I only talk about that, about persons, because I don't know what other word to use. I don't have a word, so I've just invented this one. But prosopon is in Latin, persona. And a persona is the mask that an actor in a Greek or Latin play would wear in a particular role. So if you were an evil person, you put on an evil mask. If you're a good person, you put on a good mask. And that was your persona. You see how that could be make sense like that. You say, what's your persona? Well, tonight I'm going to be a person on a podcast, right? That's what I'm presenting to other people. It's my persona, but you know, I'm not really like that. My kids certainly don't think I'm like that. So, well, that's got a very different meaning. It's you should be if you say person, you think, oh, here's somebody with a personality, and they think things and they do things, and you can touch them, and they've got an intellect perhaps or something. Some of them have anyway. But you don't think of a mask that people might put on. So that could come to have a very different meaning. See, three masks of God is different from saying three persons in one substance. And the word substance, well, it does mean sort of thing. Like, it all comes from Aristotle, these words originally. And Aristotle said a substance is a thing, like a chair. So a substance has properties. So you have a substance, that's a thing, with certain properties. So this chair is white, I believe, and it's heavy, and it's shaped in this way. Those are properties of the substance. Well, you know, modern scientists don't talk about substances with properties, really. It's not something you do. A relativity physicist would say there aren't any substances like that, really. Because I've asked one of the most famous scientists in the world, Stephen Hawking. Is he one of the most famous? What would you say things were made of? And he said, actually, they're made of probability waves in 11-dimensional hyperspace. So I said, thanks, Stephen. Would you like a drink? No, that's about it. Because what else can you say? But anyway, substance didn't come into his reply, you know, because substance goes along with a particular ancient view of the world. There are substances, and they have properties. So you, in Linnaean, if anybody is Linnaean biology, calling things, you say, well, these animals belong to this genus, this species, right? But actually, in modern biology, you wouldn't do that at all. You talk about DNA and genes, right? You wouldn't talk about the substance of the animal. You know, you don't ask questions like, what is the nature of a human being? Well, you might, but a geneticist would treat that in a different way. So you've got a mismatch, that's the point, between modern scientific language, which is itself very difficult to understand, and the ancient words, which come from ancient science, Aristotle's science, which have got themselves into the creed. So that's the problem. So what I want to do is get rid of all those ancient words. Well, say them on Sundays if you want, you know. If they're written in the book, you've got to say them. You cross your fingers. And you say, I'm really going to use modern scientific terminology. But that's actually, and so that's what I think one has to do. So if you think of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, it's no use any longer saying three persons in one substance. I don't think it's any use because it doesn't communicate the same thing that people like Augustine were trying to talk about. Hmm. What can you say? Well, just as a shot, you might say something like, the ultimate reality behind the universe is certainly a conscious intelligence, but it presents itself to us human beings in three different modes of reality, three different ways of being. All right. So there are three ways in which God is and appears to us. Basically, what are these? There's the transcendent creator of everything, far beyond space-time, whatever space-time depends upon, and people like Stephen Hawking agree that space-time depends on something. So whatever it is, that's the transcendent reality. And then reality.
And we would call that the Father.
We'd call that the Father, yeah. That's a metaphor for that, okay. And then you could say, and that same divine reality actually exists within each of us and presents itself to us as the inner divinity within each human being. We call that the Holy Spirit. Okay. And then the same reality presents itself to us in a sort of lived example of a finite object which shows and expresses the character of that reality in a way we can more or less understand. And we call that the Son. So you've got Father, Son, and Spirit, but in more scientific terminology, you've got the transcendent creator, the immanent or the indwelling divinity, and the human person who expressed perfectly in a human life the nature of God in a way we could understand, namely as forgiving love. Okay, and so you're still talking about the Trinity, you're still talking about what Augustine was talking about, but you're saying, I don't have you bound to that old language, which actually could be misleading. And sometimes people can fight about that old language. They say, no, you've got to say this and you can't say that. And I just say, well, you're all wrong.
And later in this book, Christ in the Cosmos, you say this. You can tell me if you say this or not.
If it's on paper, I must have said it. But I've forgotten.
There is indeed a cosmic trinity, and that has disclosed itself to us in ways suited to our understanding as Father, Son, and Spirit. Whatever we discover in whatever hitherto unimagined worlds we may confront in the future, this can remain an unchanging ground of Christian faith. But it does not entitle us to say that the way in which God truly appears to us is the way in which God must appear to all possible beings, or the way in which God is the divine being itself, apart from any creation. End quote.
Yep. So, I think that's quite good.
So what are those other possibilities? And how might God reveal God's self in other universes to other beings?
Okay. What you need to get here is that actually it was only in 1922, this is an incredible fact, 1922, even I wasn't alive then, but it's not very long ago. it's very recent. And in 1922, it was discovered for the first time that there were stars beyond the Milky Way. What they thought before then was that the Milky Way, that's the stars, everything is in the Milky Way. And then Edwin Hubble, in 1922, he of the telescope, right, actually said, there are stars further away. There are galaxies. He invented galaxies. That was in 1922. Now, the Bible was written just before that, I think. So when the Bible was written, nobody knew there were galaxies. Does that make a difference? Well, yeah. If you read the book of Genesis right at the beginning and you say, I would like to take this literally, there are people, I believe, in the world who think you should take it literally, but they haven't really read it, I don't think, because if you try to take it literally, what it says is the stars are sanctuary lamps, that's the word in Hebrew, lamps, hung on the dome of the sky. So the stars are underneath the sky, and then above the sky, there's a lot of water because you can see it coming down now. So it's obvious, really. So that's what the universe was like, and they thought that. So this Earth was the center of everything. This was the universe, and the stars were little lamps hung on our sky. So in 1922, Edwin Hubble said, I don't think so. There are galaxies out there, and we now know, we're pretty sure, that there are at least 300 million habitable planets in our universe. Right? There are at least 1,000 million stars in the Milky Way, and there are at least 1,000 million visible galaxies, all of which have just as many stars in them, and many of them have habitable planets, planets in that what is called the Goldilocks zone, a bit where life is able to live because it's not too hot and it's not too cold. Right, so this does make you wonder. And, of course, you Americans have put in billions of dollars into SETI, which is can't remember what it is, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, right? Is that right? Billions of dollars to find out. Now, there's this problem about this, but I shouldn't say what it is, because if I do, they might not get any more money. But the problem really is, if Einstein is right, and there is a limit to the speed of light, right? Nothing can go faster than light. I might get round to saying something about this later, but probably not. So anyway, if you can't go faster than light, then the nearest star to us, Alpha Centauri, is 4 light years away. So it would take you 4 years at your fastest possible speed to communicate with Alpha Centauri. That's 4 years. But most of the galaxies are thousands and millions of light years away. So it would take thousands of years at least to get a message to one of them. So the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, you say, hello, is anybody there? And you send it out. It takes a couple of thousand years to get there. 2,000 years after that, that's 4,000 years' time. Yes, we're listening. Communication's not going to be very easy. Now, there are ways around this which are very cunning. I mean, scientists are very cunning people sometimes. And they say people from extraterrestrial planets might have sent a very intelligent probe 2,000 years ago to our planet, and it's circling around with all the debris in space that's there, waiting to be discovered. And when we discover it, it's a bit like Superman. If you know Superman, he presses a button and his dad appears and says, "Hi, Superman, here I am." You know that? It was used to be this bloke who ate a lot of ice cream. What was his name?
Marlon Brando.
Marlon Brando, yeah. And Marlon Brando appeared and had an intelligent conversation, apparently, but he was dead. So it'll be like that, really. You were talking to dead people. Well, it's got its limitations, talking to dead people, you know. So, but that's a way around it. So how could you communicate? Of course, they've already sent out a probe, and it's just waiting to be discovered. So we might not ever communicate with them, but do they exist? Well, nobody knows. But I'd be very disappointed if they didn't. I mean, what God made all those stars for? What a waste of time if there's no life anywhere. And of course, physicists now don't just talk about this vast universe with galaxies in it. They say there might be other universes. And you did use the phrase other universes, and there might be other universes. So it's not, we get smaller and smaller, you know, really. We used to be the center of everything. Now we're hardly even there. And physicists say to me sometimes, if the universe is infinite, which some of them think it is, if it's really infinite, can you think what infinite means? It means it never ends. There's never an end. There's always more to it. So they say, I'm not sure they're right, but they are physicists, so we give them the benefit of the doubt. They say if the universe is infinite, then every possible thing will exist in it, okay, because infinite. Worse than that, every possible thing will exist an infinite number of times. So you exist an infinite number of times in other universes. Do you like that idea?
It depends. It depends on how much vacation time you get in each one.
Anyway, that's the sort of thing that physicists are really now talking about. Obviously, some physicists don't like that sort of talk, because how can you possibly find out whether it's true? But there are reasons to think that life would appear on any world which allowed it to appear. Oxygen, sufficient amount of water, whatever you want. Carbon, that'd be quite important as far as we can see. So if that's true, you would expect there to be other forms of life. And if the universe has existed for about 14,000 million years, you might expect there'd be more advanced life forms than we are. Right, what difference does it make? What were we talking about when I started all this? Oh, yes. What the Trinity might be like in one of these other life worlds, right? Given that there probably are some, but even if they're not, just have a thought experiment. Did you know, by the way, that the Big Bang, while I'm on about this, the Big Bang, the idea the universe started 14,000 million years ago, roughly, with an infinite mass compressed into a dot without any dimensions, right? No problem for a physicist. Who thought of that idea? Well, anybody like to make a guess? Yeah.
It was a Catholic priest, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a Catholic priest. That's what's interesting. Mm. It was Georges Lemaître, who was, of course, an astronomer, but he was a Catholic priest. Mm. And he thought of the Big Bang Theory, and there it is. So it's not in competition with religious beliefs. It was invented by a Catholic. Well, an Episcopalian could have done it first, but... anyway, there it is.
We're too humble, so we didn't take the credit.
No, too humble. Some people think it was Edwin Hubble, but it wasn't actually. Hubble discovered the galaxies, and he did agree with Georges Lemaître, and that was 1927 when that happened. So before I had that excursus, I was going into the question of what might the Trinity look like somewhere else. And okay, well, I'll just ask you to think about this. We talk about the Trinity, as I said, the threefold appearance of God to finite beings, right? You know, transcendent, within, and as a finite expression of the divine being. And these are three ways in which God could be to finite beings, wherever they are, in any universe. If they're beings with intelligence, God could appear in these three ways. But God wouldn't be Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or it's very unlikely. Why not? Well, you couldn't understand the word father if you lived on a planet that didn't have two different genders. All right? Father is a male parent. And it would have to be a planet where these two genders got together and had sex or something very like it and produced offspring. Right? So if a planet consisting just of amoeba, which are highly intelligent amoeba, and they just bud offspring, you wouldn't have any fathers. They wouldn't be called fathers. So that word only applies in a two-sex, sexually active planet, okay, with Y chromosomes and things like that. If you don't have those, you wouldn't have the word father. So that word wouldn't be used. Right. Well, does that mean anything? Yeah, because there are Christians going around the place who say it's very important to understand that God in God's self is really Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And that's what God is. And when you say God is Trinity, you're getting to the inner essence of God. So you know God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But that can't be right. Because Father is such a very earthly term. It belongs to this planet. So I would say, yeah, for this planet, God can be called a Father. But you know, even that's got its limitations. I would say Mother as well, parent. But we got Father, it's in the liturgy. Keep having these things you have to say, fingers crossed, as they say, right. Right, it doesn't have to be called Father, but it could still be a transcendent creator. And the same with Son. I mean, that's a real problem, God the Son. Because even a Muslim, you don't have to go to the Alpha Centauri. You can talk to a Muslim down the road. And the Muslim would say, God has no son. In fact, we used to run interfaith services where I live in Oxford, and Muslims and Christians. Now, the trouble with this is neither of us knew what the other ones were talking about because Muslims pray in Arabic, right? And we, being biblical scholars, prayed in Greek, so it was all Greek to them and all Arabic to us. But what was going on was they were all using this section from the Quran, God has no son. They were using the same, yes, yes, yes. It's like problems of interfaith dialogue. So, of course, it's true that God has no son in the sense of God wasn't sexually active. You know, a Muslim myth, it's not believed by intelligent, theologically educated Muslims, but a Muslim myth is that God had sexual relations with Mary and produced a son. Right. Well, every Christian knows, I think, that that's not what we mean. So what do we mean? Unfortunately, we've got the Gospel of John. And the Gospel of John starts off, remember the beginning of the Gospel of John? In the beginning was the Word. I didn't say son. Now that is a Greek word, but back to the language problem again, really. And the Greek is logos. And you say, what does logos mean? Well, that's a very difficult question, right? But you've got to translate it, you see. Why are there so many translations of the Bible? Because the Greek words are very hard to translate. If you've tried translating a thing into another language, you know you can't quite get it right. I mean, the best example is that lovely German word, Schadenfreude. Now, I don't know if you've ever suffered from Schadenfreude. Some people say it, I think. Do you say it in America? Mm-hmm. Oh, you do? Oh, there you are. But if you say, what does it mean? We don't have an English word for it. There's not one word. You use a phrase. You have a paraphrase for it, right? Rejoicing in the sorrow of others. Okay. So, or you might not like that, you might have another chance. So that's why you have lots of translations, different ways of putting a word. So the word logos has lots of different possible translations. I'll give you a few of them. Wisdom, Torah, a Jewish word, as you know, for law or teaching. Intellect, reason, right? Template, as a sort of archetype. So that word logos is a very multivalent word. It does have, anybody who says it's got one meaning and I know what it is wrong. Because the word was written down 2,000 years ago by somebody in a social context that we don't have a very good grasp of. Some people are better than others. Obviously, I'd say you're not competent to talk about what that word means unless you've studied ancient Greek linguistics and got a couple of PhDs. Well, that rules me out for a start, and I'm a professor, so you haven't got a hope, right? And you say, well, I go to an expert, but even they will say, if you really press them, well, we don't really, we can't be certain about this. And that's very important. We can't be certain about this. There's a range of meanings. So, but something like wisdom or intellect or reason. I like the word thought myself. You could say that. In the beginning was a thought, and the thought was with God, and it was God because it was God's thought. So your thoughts are with you. You're coming out of you, and they're part of you. Your thoughts are part of what you are. So that seems to fit. I like that, but nobody else likes that, so nobody says it. But it's a thought anyway. So now word is better, I think, as a metaphor than sun. But they have to refer to the same being. And so calling Jesus word qualifies what you might think of when you say God is the Son of God, okay? For a start, word is not male. Son is male. And I remember going around Antwerp Cathedral with a guide who didn't know I knew anything about theology or Christianity, and he was explaining what things were. And we came to a picture of the font in the cathedral, and he said, well, these are the three great Christian symbols. It's the Father, the Son, and the Holy Bird. In fact, what he actually said was Holy Pigeon, which is even worse, unless you like pigeons. And that shows you the difficulty of these words, the Holy Pigeon. I mean, it's not really quite... the way we think of God, you know, God is a holy pigeon. I mean, we laugh at people who worship holy cucumbers, but they're no worse than holy pigeons. Anyway, so there you are. We don't mean pigeon, and we don't really mean sun, and we don't really mean word, because word is impersonal. A word that you speak is not a person. That's another problem. So these are all metaphors, and they play off and modify each other. So, again, son, being a male offspring, wouldn't have a meaning in a planet in which there weren't male offspring. Mm. So you wouldn't talk about father and son. Spirit, well, that word, what is that? It is a word which comes from words for air or breath. Right? It's pneuma in Greek, or it's ruach in Hebrew. And again, you've got the same problem. What do you mean by spirit? And very difficult to define, but it's to do with air. It's like the breath of life. Okay, you might say the spirit is the breath of life. When God breathed into life, then that God gave spirit to, and that includes dogs. You'd be glad, well, English people would be glad to know. I've seen a lot of dogs here as well, so you must like dogs. And cats, beetles, not sure. God is the holy beetle. No, that doesn't. Actually, when the missionaries went to talk to the Inuit and they tried to translate the Bible and they said Jesus was the good shepherd and he said, feed my sheep. Inuit have never seen a sheep, didn't know what a sheep was. So they translated this as God is a great farmer and he said, feed my penguins. Anyway, so that was a different... A different connotation. So probably spirit wouldn't be used either because it's to do with breath. So if you weren't an air-breathing life form, you wouldn't use that term either. So all this is just to say, well, these terms, Father, Son, and Spirit, are for us on this planet. Now, we may be the only beings there are. Nobody knows this, but it looks as though there are lots of other possibilities. So if you say, well, are we going to send missionaries out to Betelgeuse or some other galaxy somewhere and tell them that they should be talking about Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? And if they could translate it into English, they'd say, well, we don't have any fathers or sons, and we don't breathe air, so it doesn't mean much to us. So you probably wouldn't say that. So I do want to say, everywhere in this universe, if beings think, they will conceive of a divine creator who is threefold in being transcended, immanent, and expressed in a finite objective entity. That makes sense. You'd say, yeah, that'd be good for God to be like that. So in a sense, it's true, but this is God in relation to specific beings of specific sorts. And I think that's a very valuable thought, because it gets you away from this anthropomorphic thought that God has to look human. You know, if you go in the Sistine Chapel, if you've been in the Sistine Chapel, and you get this famous picture by Michelangelo, there's Adam, and there's God touching the finger. But there's a picture of God. Right? He's got a beard. That's okay. he's pretty old. That's okay. He's bigger than me. God, you can't draw that sort of picture and say that's God. I mean, Muslims and Jews prohibit you doing that, and I think they're right, really. You shouldn't draw God. You can draw Jesus, because Jesus, after all, was human, but you shouldn't draw God. And so you might think, well, this gets us away from that anthropomorphic thing. You know, if you go to an old church in Europe, on the walls, you'll see human beings there, and you see Jesus in heaven ruling everybody. There's nobody else there, it's just human beings. And Jesus is the top human being. Mary, second. And then you've got a few other saints. And then you've got some people down there having a bad time. But up here, everybody's human. Even the angels are human. They've got wings, but, you know, they're human. Some people even think they're ladies. I don't know why they would think that. Anyway, they look human. So I think the time has come to get rid of all that imagery. I'm not going to pull down the churches. They're pretty. I'm not going to pull down the Sistine Chapel. But you have to say, great painting, bad theology. and nobody must think that's what God is like. It's just not like that at all. There are lots of other mistakes in the Sistine Chapel, but I won't go into that. Was that an answer to the question? That was my short answer.
No, it's perfect. It's perfect. I'm the Reverend Broderick Greer, and this is Theology Live. This evening, I'm with Professor Keith Ward, former Regius Professor of Divinity at Oxford University.
Perhaps you can see why I'm former.
I did not write this question, but it's kind of occurred to me as we're wrapping up. If you were rewriting the creeds, how would you formulate God?
Well, I've got nothing against metaphor, so I'm not sure I'd rewrite the creeds. I just say you've got to see they're metaphorical. I mean, you take the sentence in the Apostles' Creed virtually every day, and that is Jesus ascended into heaven and sits at the right hand of God. Well, I don't mind saying that, but as long as it's a metaphor, because sitting at the right hand of somebody is making them important. Right, if you're at the right hand, you're an important person. Yeah, you've got a key role. You might be God's representative on earth. You know, that's the best thing you could be, I imagine. But you're not sitting on a seat next to God, who has another hand, and presumably somebody else sitting over there. And it's got to be the right hand, you know. So all of that, you would say, God has no body. We know this. We know God doesn't have a body. So we can't mean he's really sitting at the right hand of God. So you must mean it as a metaphor. So you can apply that throughout the creed. And you say, God ascended into heaven. Well, heaven's not up there. If Einstein is right and Jesus ascended through the sky, he'd just have reached Alpha Centauri by about now. And he's still going. Right. In an infinite universe, he's going forever. So he's going to sit at the right hand of God, you'd have to say. And he's going to come again. He's going to come all the way back. So just take metaphor, seriously and say, well, there is a spiritual truth there. Ascending to heaven is being unified with the divine reality, and sitting at the right hand of God is being the expression of the divine on the earth for human beings, and then that makes sense. So I wouldn't actually change that particularly, right? And of course, some things were true. I mean, he was crucified. That's not a metaphor. And I think he rose from the dead. That's not a metaphor either, right? Though, depending on what you mean by the word rose, you know, different accounts of exactly what happened. I remember the Archbishop of Canterbury, long time ago, nobody here will know who he was. Michael Ramsay, anyway, he was the Archbishop of Canterbury. He was a very learned scholar. In those days, they used to do that sort of thing. So he was the Archbishop of Canterbury. He gave a series of lectures on the resurrection in Cambridge. I was listening to them, actually. And he gave all these lectures, and the conclusion of the lectures was, well, he said, we do not know exactly what the resurrection was, but whatever it was, I firmly believe it. Which gets the prize for ambiguity, I think.
Amazing.
I think it's very important in the Christian faith to say there are actually many interpretations of many key words, including God, and including Christ, and including Son and Word. Well, the list goes on. You say there's not just one true interpretation. And that, as I say, is why you have so many different interpretations of the Bible. They're always coming out. And they're all different, and that's because you can't put it into words which have a precise meaning. So let's have a fuzzy religion. That's why I'm an Episcopalian, because I've got a fuzzy faith. And I think that's great. Some people say, why don't you have a less fuzzy faith? And I say, because when I did, I was wrong. Right? So what happens when you make things more precise is you just make mistakes. And also you get into arguments with other people all the time, because they make it something different, and then you get into different arguments about what precisely, you know, was Jesus 5 feet high or 5 feet six high, or did he have a beard or not? I don't know. Did he drink wine or did he drink Ribena or orange juice? Well, we don't know. So that's the phrase, we don't know. I think that should be the motto of Anglicans. We believe in God, but we don't know.
You heard it here first. Let's give Professor Ward a hand. It is difficult to leave a discussion like this without a sense of awe, an impulse to drop to our knees, completely intoxicated by things unseen. In Christian parlance, mystery leads to awe, and awe leads to doxology. Any word of praise, any sentence of thanksgiving to God tends to spring forth from dumbfoundedness after conversations like this one. So instead of explaining and explaining, maybe the most appropriate thing to do is sit in silence, pen a poem, or take a long walk. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Mr. Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. We offer special thanks to Keith Ward, the J. Etkin Gallery, and our visual artist, Mr. Josh Colfer. We will miss our listening audience during our summer hiatus, but look forward to being with you again on September 7th, 2017, when Science Mike discusses his return to Christian faith through science after a serious stint as an atheist. Visit 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology for updates about our live events. If you have not already, subscribe to Theology Live on your preferred podcast platform, then help enhance our digital visibility by reviewing us on iTunes. Thank you all very much.